Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jennifer Lahl. She's founder and president of the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network. She couples her 25 years of experience as a pediatric critical care nurse, a hospital administrator, and a senior-level nursing manager with a deep passion to speak for those who have no voice. She's called upon to speak alongside lawmakers and members of the scientific community, even being invited to speak to members of the European Parliament in Brussels to address issues of egg trafficking. She serves on the North American Editorial Board for Ethics in Medicine. She made her writing and directing debut producing the documentary film Eggsploitation, which has been awarded Best Documentary by the California Independent Film Festival and sold in more than 30 countries. She's also director, executive producer, and co-writer of Anonymous Father's Day, a documentary film exploring the stories of women and men who were created by an anonymous sperm donation. Her latest film, Breeders, a Subclass of Women, on surrogacy, was released January 2014 and completes the trilogy of films exploring the ethics of third-party reproduction. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm happy to be with you.
Well, thanks. So my first question is, what is egg trafficking, and what are some of the problems with it?
Sure. Well, egg trafficking, when you think of any other kind of trafficking, trafficking in persons, trafficking in organs, it is the trafficking, the buying and selling, the trading of human eggs on the global international market. As you mentioned when you introduced me, that I spoke at the European Parliament in Brussels several years back because the European communities were quite concerned about a growing trade of eggs coming out of Eastern European countries. And at that time, the European Parliament actually issued a resolution which broadened their trafficking in person language and laws to include the trafficking in not only persons, but body parts, and human eggs are a body part. What's wrong with it? Wow, how much time do we have, Derek? And where do I start? There's a lot of things that are wrong with it. One is just the global sale of human body parts, human eggs, which comes with all the problems that you can imagine with profit motives. Who is selling and who is buying? It's always the low-income, impoverished women who are enticed to sell their eggs, even though we use the word donor, donation all the time. We talk about egg donation. There, make no mistake, there's not really a donation happening here. There's a lot of money that's trading hands. And there's clearly a lot of problems that I raise in my documentary film work, which is the health risks. I mean, most people don't think that egg harvesting and getting women's eggs out of their body is as onerous as it really is. And so, we go into, impoverished countries. We exploit women for their body parts, their eggs, and we leave them behind without access to proper medical care and medical follow-up. One of the dirty little secrets here in the United States that I raise all the time, we don't have as clearly as the poverty levels as you see in what's happening out of Africa and Eastern European countries. But we don't track or monitor or follow up any of these women. So there's no data out there on what are the short and the long-term risks and harms that these women expose their bodies to. You know, we're all concerned about all the hormones in our food and our water and our environment and how, close the ecosystem is so tightly connected to all of us, plants, animals, birds, whatever. And then we go into these markets and we encourage women to put all these powerful drugs into their body without any concern that it might be harmful to them. But we shudder when we think of those kinds of drugs in our food that we eat. So it's the kind of stuff that keeps me awake at night.
Well, let's back up a second and go through the process, because I don't really know what happens. So let's say that I am part of some couple in the United States and we, for whatever reason, can't have a child. And then am I right so far that this is how it starts? And then I've got some money. And so I give this money to somebody, and then what are the processes? I mean, follow through the process of how how somebody in, I don't know, Zimbabwe or Indonesia or somewhere ends up, a woman, not somebody, gives up their egg. How does the whole thing work?
Yeah. And I think just to make one point of clarification, and then I'll walk you through the step-by-step process. There's actually two markets that are competing for eggs on the global market. There's the market of people like you describe, a couple that can't have a child unless they use eggs from another woman. And there's also the scientific community that needs eggs to just do basic, all kinds of research that they do on embryos and eggs and stem cell cloning, whatever. You know, there's two markets that are competing, and you'll see if you know people wanted to Google this, world egg banks. There's this huge now market that's being set up to become, you know, we have the most eggs here, whether you're trying to make a baby or you're trying to do scientific research. So come to us because we have the largest database of eggs banked in our, you know, egg bank. So these women will enter.
So sort of like Egg Mart or Eggs R Us or something.
Exactly. And, you know, the bigger their database, the more that they boast, you know, we've got for the people that want to make babies, they'll say we have, you know, Stanford, NYU, Columbia, blonde haired, blue eyed, high SAT, speaks French, plays the violin, athletic, you know, gene rich people. And for the basic scientific researcher, we just have, you know, vats and vats of eggs. So come here and get your eggs. So you'll see women being treated a little bit differently based on how they enter into this market. So my intel with people that work in African countries, they're poaching eggs. I use the word egg poachers, you know, off of young women as young as 11 and 12 years old. And they're paying them about $13 for a batch of their eggs because they're just going to the researcher who doesn't care if they're pretty and they're smart and they're at Stanford studying for a PhD. So there's those two markets. So these women are enticed by advertisement to recruit them heavily, you know, to make dreams come true or solve the next disease, you know, help advance science for money. And so money is the hook. And then once they're in the system, you get these women on three regimens of drugs. And these are all injectable drugs. They're all out there on the market. Some of them have been FDA approved for this particular use, but many of them have not been, which means they haven't passed the safety for a particular use, but they've passed whatever safety to get them onto the market and used. So they'll take one round of medication that they inject in their bodies that puts them into a medically induced menopause. So it just puts their ovaries to sleep as if they're a 65-year-old woman.
And this could be an 11-year-old. It could be.
It could be an 11-year-old, as long as she's, you know, menstruating. She has to, you know,
right.
She has to have mature. And, you know, we know that because of all the environmental things that are going on, you know, young girls are menstruating much younger than they did. You know, I'm 57, you know, when I was a teenager. So it's not uncommon for 9 and 10 and 11-year-old girls to be having their monthly, you know, periods. So they put them on this first regimen that just puts their ovaries to sleep. Because then the next regimen is another drug that they put them on, injecting, which puts their ovaries in hyperdrive so that they naturally produce one egg a month. But in this unnatural state, they're going to produce 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 eggs in one cycle. Because this is money driven, Derek. And if you're going to pay a young woman $12 or $50,000 if she's at Stanford or $12 if she's in Africa, you want as many eggs as you can get. Because back to the trafficking, you can go out and broker those eggs on the world market. You can put those eggs in your world egg bank. So she's put on this, you know, regimen to hyper-stimulate her ovaries, produce lots and lots of eggs. And then she receives a final injection, which is called the trigger shot, which basically releases the eggs from their little follicles. Think of a bunch of grapes hanging on a vineyard. And, you know, each little grape has inside the seeds. Well, each little follicle has inside the eggs. So then they want to release those eggs to make them much more easy for the surgical procedure, which is, you know, going in and puncturing the ovary and sucking out these eggs. And if you have 60 eggs, you know, your audience needs to know that there's 60 times that that woman's ovary is going to be punctured with a needle. Because they have to suck out each egg out of each little sac. And that's sort of the beginning to end. It can be about a 4-week process. It can be stretched out longer. I've interviewed egg donors who are selling their eggs to an affluent couple, and they'll say, you know what, we're getting ready to go on a vacation, so we need you to stay on the medication longer because we won't be ready for the eggs until we come back from vacation. So, you know, we're just going to let you coast out there in this suspended state of hyperstimulation.
So I'm gonna ask this next question, but I want to preface it, because you don't really know me, I want to preface it by being very clear that I am being ironic in throwing this to you.
Okay.
That isn't this just a great example of neoliberal capitalism at its best? There is a woman in Africa who needs money, and there are scientists at, Mayo Clinic or somewhere who need eggs, and capitalism has done a great job of bringing them together. And I once again, I want to preface this by saying I hate capitalism. So this is, you know, damning with faint praise or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's biological colonialism. It's, you know, medical ethics gone totally off of its rack, its tracks. It's feminine. You know, I often say, where are the feminists, and where's the feminist outrage in all this? And have, you know, feminists bought into, you know, everything is for, can be bought and sold, and everything is up for, you know, the highest bidder, and can we make, you know, what can't we, you know, not sell and not profit off of? You know, the debate I have with my feminist colleagues is that, you know, there's a huge schism right now between, you know, if you look at what's happening with Amnesty International and the whole prostitution debate, and is prostitution sex work, and, you know, I'm of the side of, I would never, ever risk a young woman's health because I need something from her body for my gain. Whereas, you know, I have feminist colleagues on the other side. It's her body, it's her right, it's her choice, and, you know, let the markets decide what she can make. So it's pretty disgusting to me that, you know, we have our healthcare professionals, and I use that with quote, scare quotes, and the market, and just greedy customers who say, I want a baby, I have the money, you know, let me have at that woman's body.
I completely agree with you, and I want to say in fairness to at least some feminists that I was introduced to your work through a couple of women who just think you're a couple of feminists, radical feminists, who think your work is completely fantastic. Let's talk just a little bit more, I was going to say, let's talk about that schism between choice and what is best for both society at large and for health. But maybe instead the direction to go is just to talk more about the obvious. Well, it seems to me that it's pretty obvious that doing all of that stuff is going to really harm a woman, that sort of intervention, or what word do we use? That sort of extraction, that sort of harvesting, has got to lead to some potentially very harmful effects for her. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, and I, you know, forgive me if I painted my feminist colleagues with too broad of a stroke. Of course, I work very closely with many great men, women that support and agree with my point of view on this issue. But it is just a historic moment where you see women who would self-identify as radical feminists very much divided on the market side and the commodification of our sisters' bodies. So,
And after we talk more about the health, I want to talk more about the commodification and come back to that, because I think that's really, really important. But let's talk for a moment more about the health effects of flooding the of stopping of inducing early menopause and then causing the eggs to drop at once. That seems pretty dreadful to me.
It's an absolute absolute brutal process. And you can go on their chat rooms where these young women who are, you know, egg donors are chatting about their experiences. They talk about how their bellies are so big they can't even, you know, button their jeans. You know, I've interviewed in my film women who talked about feeling like they were 6, 7, 8 months pregnant. And, you know, when you think about this whole process of the medical induced menopause and then, you know, then flipping the switch that takes the ovaries from basically, you know, asleep, totally stopped experience, you know, to this hyperstimulation, hyperdrive. And we're thinking, gosh, you know, this is what we're doing to a, you know, the delicate, fragile human body that works in such, you know, synchronism together, that's, you know, very cyclical, and there's rhythms, and there's, you know, the ebb and flow of our hormones and the regulation of our hormones from our pituitary gland. I mean, it's a very orchestrated thing. And then we just get in there and medically manipulate it. So you can imagine that there of course would be all kinds of just short-term harms to that. You know, these women that normally are producing, like I said, one egg a month, and all of a sudden their ovaries are producing 60, and all this fluid and all this edema, and the fluid has to go somewhere. And so it creeps out. And you know, two of the women in my film suffered in the very short term massive strokes. Because if you know anything about the body, when there's excess fluid, you know, fluid has to go somewhere. It's like in your house, if you have a leak, water has to go somewhere. And so sometimes it makes its way into your lungs, and it pushes up on all your vital organs. So there's all the short term. There's a short term complications of just, you know, infection and all the risk of surgery and anesthesia. It's not like a guy donating a sperm. I mean, there's no health risk to, you know, being a sperm donor, and there's all sorts of health risks to these women that take these drugs and undergo this procedure. Then, Derek, what's even more concerning in the larger unknown, which is where we're really playing with fire, is what is the long-term effect of these drugs and this procedure and doing this to your body on these young women? The American Society of Reproductive Medicine, which is the professional body in the United States that governs this area of medicine, says that a young woman should not do this any more than 6 times. But, you know, me as somebody who has a, you know, a science undergraduate degree, I want to know why 6 times. That is a meaningless number. It's not based on any scientific studies. It doesn't say should a woman do it 6 times, meaning once a year for 6 years. Can a woman do it every single month for 6 months in a row? What is the cumulative effect on her own reproductive health? You know, women are born with all the eggs that they'll ever have, you know, and are we robbing a woman's own future fertility because we've just stolen all of, you know, poached all of her eggs out of her body? And there's also the link of cancer. It's well documented in the literature that these hormones have a direct link, you know, to reproductive cancers in particular. And here we're taking a healthy person. This isn't a patient who said, I'm sick and okay, I'll take the risk of the drugs because otherwise I'm not going to get better or I might die. You know, and as patients, we often make those kind of calculations as we weigh risk against benefit. But here's a woman who's not sick and she's not a patient and there's no firewall. She's being treated by the industry, the medical professionals whose allegiance is to their patient, who's paying them, you know, 50 and 60 and hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a baby. So there's all kinds of exposure, if you will, to this young woman's short-term and her long-term health.
So it's striking me that this is the same pattern. Well, there's a bunch of patterns that are the same as we see everywhere else. But one of the patterns that's the same as we see everywhere else is that, you know, they'll put in a dam on a river and say this is not going to harm the river. Or they will say that they can cut down this forest and the Forest Service will do an environmental impact statement and say that it will have no significant impact. And we hear – I mean, the precautionary principle would say that if there is a risk of harm, you don't go forward until you have guaranteed that there is no harm. And this is especially true within the medical industry, where the, you know, the fundamental oath is do no harm. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand how you can do processes like this and not without a significant risk.
Absolutely. I mean, I speak before audiences all the time and say, listen, you don't have to be a doctor to get this kind of stuff. You don't have to be a scientist. Anybody knows you put all kinds of crap, pardon my French, you know, junk into a person's body and tell that body to do something that body is never meant to do. That's got to have some kind of a negative impact on it. I liken a lot of what the work that I do to the early tobacco industry fight. You know, remember when Big Tobacco was out there pushing all their cigarettes and telling everybody it's not harmful? You know, there's no risk to smoking whatsoever. And everybody was puffing away and smoking away, and billboards and Hollywood movies and movie stars and the films where everybody was smoking. And then all of a sudden, you know, Marlboro Man died. And he died of lung cancer. And, you know, doctors started saying, hey, we're seeing things in our offices that, you know, are, you know, the anecdotal stuff of people with lung disease and respiratory infections and cancers. You know, only then did we study it. And then we found out, yes, there is a connection. And we, you know, we got the warning labels on cigarettes and, you know, did our huge public awareness educational campaign, Don't Smoke. And this is, I think, in this industry, because I, you know, you introduced me and people know I have a nursing background. I mean, I'm just ashamed of reproductive fertility doctors that would treat women this way. But I think we're at a tipping point. You know, one of the criticisms always of my work is that the stories I tell the women I've interviewed and show in my films, well, that's just anecdotal. You know, there's risk to anything. You walk across the street, you take the risk of getting hit by a bus, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. But I do think that we're at a tipping point in what, you know, the power of the internet. You know, I tell people all the time, I don't usually find the women that I interview. They find me. Because what happens when you're harmed? You know, most of the time people now go to the internet. You know, we start doing our research and they say, oh, here's a woman who's speaking out about the risk to young women who are being asked to sell their eggs. So hopefully, you know, we can get past this, you know, divide within feminism. You know, I'm in the Silicon Valley. It's very libertarian out here. Everybody just wants contracts. As long as everybody's agreed and everybody's signed the contract, you know, do whatever the heck you want. But, you know, we are our brother's keeper. We should care about one another. And I'm hoping that, you know, just getting the message out on shows like yours will educate more and more people.
So let's talk about the history of this. How long has it been happening and what is the scope of it? How many, I mean, you've talked about, you know, sort of the egg markets, but are these still fairly small? Is this large? And once again, history, when did it start? When did the technology make this an option? And how big is it in both markets, both the actual baby market and the research market?
Yeah. Well, again, back to the dirty little secret, you know, because we don't track and we don't monitor and we don't follow up, we don't have a central database. So we have one little body of tracking in the United States, which comes out from the Centers for Disease Control, and they do an annual report that just tracks a little bit. So, for example, the most recent study we have is 2012 data, which is already, you know, almost 4 years out of date, shows that I think, you know, there was roughly 157,000 IVF, in vitro fertilization cycles done in the U.S. that year, with about 57,000 live births. And that number over the year has been trending up. But historically, you know, all of this sort of the floodgates opened with the birth of Louise Brown, which was the first test tube baby, she was called, born in the United Kingdom. And I want to say it's 1998. I'm sorry, I should have that number just burned in my brain. But it was at that moment when, you know, they were able to create the first human baby embryo in the laboratory, get that embryo transfer back up into Mrs. Brown's body, and then 9 months later, little Louise was born, when sort of I tell people at that moment the gloves were off, because we were able to figure out how to make embryos in the lab and get them back in the woman and then have babies. And, you know, before then it was this all old, low-tech stuff, you know, artificial insemination. Just think veterinarian farmers, you know, who were inseminating cows and pigs. You know, they did that to women in, who were having trouble conceiving. 5 years after Louise Brown was born, we have the first documented baby born in the medical literature that was born using donor eggs. So, you know, that would have been, you know, another sort of threshold moment, if you will, when we thought, oh, not only can we help, you know, Joe and Betty have a baby with Joe's sperm and Betty's egg, but now we can get sperm from a donor bank and egg from a donor bank and make babies for Joe and Betty. And since then, it's just trending upwards. You know, it's just, you know, it's become more mainstream. I mean, Hollywood and the tabloids, every time you turn around, there's another celebrity that's had a baby through surrogacy or egg donation. I'm in California. We had the Octomom scandal, you know, with the woman had eight babies. You know, Elton John and his partner have come to California twice, you know, to have children here because part of the trafficking and trade problem is we don't have global laws. And so, you know, he had to leave the United Kingdom to come to California where it's the wild, wild west and anything goes. And our fertility clinics in California advertise by how close they are to Disneyland. So they encourage, you know, reproductive tourism and trade and trafficking. But the numbers, you know, are just anyone's guess because we don't track and follow up. This is one industry that's really gotten away. They're making fistfuls of money with no accountability and no exposure to having to protect those that have been harmed.
And how big, I know you just said that there's not really track, but do we have an idea how big the market is for eggs for scientific research?
Yeah, that's even a more difficult, because if you can imagine, say you're a woman and you've just been super ovulated and they got 60 eggs from you, we don't barcode where those eggs end up. You know, if you go into the blood bank and you donate blood, we know that the blood came from Derek on this date and it went to Jennifer. You know, so there's that kind of a paper trail, if you will, from when something leaves one human body and where does it end up. When eggs leave a human body, we don't know where they end up. So I talked to scientific researchers and a lot of our big academic institutions in the United States conveniently have assisted reproductive technology services as well as scientific research services. So say prominent University A has everybody coming there to get their babies. When there's extra eggs, when there's extra embryos, you know, somebody's not going to want 60 children, even though they got 60 eggs. They'll say, hey, scientific researcher, do you need some embryos or do you need some eggs? Because we have extra ones over here. And there's a whole grading process. So when eggs leave a body, they get graded. And so because it's all profit driven, it's all success driven, it's all outcome based, everybody wants a baby at the end. You know, the best eggs get chosen. And then the lower quality eggs either get put in the freezer or thrown away or given to research. So there's no tracking. I mean, you can't spit in a cup in a hospital without it getting barcoded and labeled sent to pathology. They take gallstones out of people. They take skin tags off of people. But in this area of egg and sperm, it's beyond me why we don't track and know where that all ends up.
So let's talk for a moment about the colonialist and resourcification implications of all this. You've mentioned it a couple times, but can you... I am officially begging you to do a rant on objectification, resourcification, and colonialism as regards this.
Oh, gosh. I should have had a cocktail if you wanted me to do a rant. yeah, I mean, it's like, really, has it just come full circle back to, are we ever going to learn our lessons as people? It's the rich who buy and it's the poor who sell. And we want to dress it all up with language of choice and freedom and autonomy. You know, we want to talk about, you know, the, you know, what we need to do is regulate, because as long as we regulate it, everybody will be happy and protected. But, you know, that song and dance has been tried over and over and over again in human history. And it never ends up well for the people low on the totem pole. You know, if we regulate and if we try to build in all those kind of phony protections, it protects the wealthy stakeholders. You know, and at the end of the day, whether, you know, this might be controversial, but I tell people, you know, because now we have a growing population of young people that are here on the planet because their mothers, fathers, parents, whatever you want to call them, purchased egg and sperm on the open market. And there's a growing discontent coming from the voices of these people who are saying, you know, I'm not so cool with this. Yes, I'm happy to be here. Yes, I'm thankful that I have a life and I'm, you know, able to complain about my displeasure here. But, you know, there's something about knowing that, you know, some man was paid $50 or so, some woman at Stanford or wherever. I say Stanford because it's in my backyard. No reason to bash on. Just Stanford here. But there's something about knowing you're here because somebody was paid to give up their genetic, you know, heritage, their genetic line, their genetic material. So it's going to be interesting in this next, you know, 5 to 10 years. To see how all this shakes down. We're going to see more and more ill health. And of course, those women won't be represented. They'll be told it's your fault. It's something you did wrong. There's nothing we did wrong. You know, it's back to your earlier, you know, analogy about, you know, the impact studies. Everything's fine. And if something goes wrong, nobody will ever take blame for it. It's because of something else. I don't know if that was the rant you were looking for, but it's more of a, I'm more dismayed, I guess, that we just can't seem to learn our lessons.
Yeah. So I'm going to go the opposite direction for a second and say something once again, ironically, which is what about all these just poor, desperate, well, they're not, they're rich actually, but the desperate couples who want to have a baby, and it seems you want to deprive them of that little bundle of joy. And the same with, you know, you want to basically stop all scientific research in its tracks, and you must hate knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you've gotten some variant of those.
Oh, yeah. No, I get that all the time. You know, she's trying to take away our rights to have a child. I remember showing up to testify at a Senate hearing, and the women were lining the hallways, and they had pictures of their babies in frames, and they were crying and saying, "She's trying to take away our rights to have a baby." And for one, I don't believe you have a right to have a baby. You know, if you happen to get pregnant, of course you have a right to that child. You know, that's growing in your body, that's yours, but you don't have a right to go out there on the open market and buy eggs and buy sperm and buy a poor surrogate, you know, woman's womb. And, you know, so I am not taking away people's rights to have a child. If anything, you know, people have to sort of step back and think, have we, you know, made having a child sort of the ultimate status symbol, or I get that people want to have children. I'm not denying that, but you know, this extreme that we've gotten ourselves to, where we'll go, you know, you hear people that will spend hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and back to the CDC data, most IVF cycles fail. I mean, overwhelmingly, and we've been at this since the 1990s, and it's failure after failure, and we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. We've gotten to the point where we are making insurance providers extend medical coverage to cover all this very costly technology that fails most of the time, you know, to people that just have a particular lifestyle choice. You know, we have a growing demographic of single people just by choice. Well, I don't need a partner. I can just go on the open market and, you know, buy the missing parts. And now we're extending healthcare benefits to people that don't have a medical need. And this isn't like an illness that you will die from. I mean, you might be sad if you can't have a child, but it's not like, you know, a deadly life sentence of a diagnosis that you've been given. So, and again, back to the fact that this is relatively new technology, we sort of survived on the planet for a long, long time having infertile couples in our midst. And is that perhaps an opportunity for us to exercise our maternal, paternal parenting desires in better ways? I mean, God knows we have enough, you know, children on the planet that, you know, could use some love and some care and some community.
And what about the scientific, you know, you being against the mighty march of progress?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think this technology is a classic example of how we stopped looking at, this technology found a workaround, and it's a very short-term workaround. We stopped looking at the problem and how can we address and find solutions to the problem. I mean, we have to get real. A lot of growing infertility in the United States and Western countries is not infertility. It's because women and men have waited too long. So they're not, I will tell women over and over again, they'll say, well, I got married when I was 40. I tried to start having my children when I was 42 or 44, and I'm struggling with infertility. I'm like, no, it's called menopause. You're not infertile. Your body is menopause. There's nothing, this is a natural process of your body. But we have stopped looking at, you know, what's driving all this infertility. Obesity is driving huge amounts of infertility in Western countries. We're too fat. All the environmental elements, you know, that are caustic and hostile to our bodies are having a negative impact on fertility. So why don't we look at solutions and treatments and scientific progress in a way that doesn't hurt one person so that I can get what I want, or hurt the environment so I can get what I want, or I've got the money to buy, so why can't I get what I want? And I'm helping her. That's another thing that people tell me a lot. I'm helping to lift this woman out of poverty by buying her eggs or buying her womb from her. Why don't we look at real solutions and real answers to infertility?
It seems also that one of the things that's happening here is, I mean, just the whole time you've been talking, I've been thinking about something that I think about all the time anyway, which is this culture's preference for the artificial over the embodied. And I'm thinking, for example, just yesterday, you know, the day before we're talking about this, they realized there might be water on Mars. And they get all excited about that, but of course, what are they doing to the water on this planet? They're polluting it everywhere. And so there's this – I'm just – the whole time you're talking, I keep thinking about how this deep distrust of what is natural and this preference for what comes out of the laboratory. Is any of this making any sense to you?
Yeah, and I totally get that. I remember interviewing a woman, and she runs an agency for a support group for families that have children through egg donation. And I remember talking to her and saying, you know, just chit-chatting. You know, I knew where she lived, so I knew she lived in a pretty green state. You know, I asked her about her, you know, diet and what kind of, and she's like, oh yeah, we're totally organic. We, you know, stay away from pesticides. We make sure we eat really clean and blah, blah, blah. And I said, but isn't that interesting? You're willing to take an otherwise healthy young woman and ask her to do something to her body because she had something you needed. So we live in this kind of schizophrenic. We, you know, we are very careful. We read labels. We want to make sure all this. And then we'll turn a blind eye and we'll go over and pollute over here. And I said, you know, we really need to integrate that. You know, we talk about this whole new market now of, you know, women and Facebook and Google and Apple and all, they're offering the benefit now so their female employees can freeze and bank their eggs. So they won't have to go and poach eggs off of another healthy young woman. They can use their own eggs and bank them. And I go, isn't that interesting? If you go to the farmer's market and then you go to the grocery store and you go, I got these beautiful peas from the farmer's market, or I've got this bag of frozen peas in the, you know, the frozen food aisle at the grocery store. Which do you want? You know, you want the natural. You want the fresh. You want them right out of the garden if you can. And here we're willing to freeze our eggs for, what, 10, 15, 20 years and then make our children from frozen eggs? But then we go to the grocery store, you know, we say, no, we don't want the frozen vegetables. We want the organic, you know, farm-to-table food. We have to put this stuff back together.
I want to, you know, you've talked a lot about the exploitation of the poor, but I want to come back to one of the very first things you said, that when you were in Brussels, you were talking about the importation of eggs from Eastern Europe. And it... or the harvesting of eggs from Eastern Europe. And you also explicitly but briefly made the connection to the prostitution of women and the trafficking of women. And I want to just highlight what you said about Eastern Europe, because when we think about trafficking in Eastern European women, we normally think of sex trafficking. And so do you want to talk a little bit more about that? The connection in terms of the fact that both of them are being exploited because of their poverty.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that every part of the human body, and in particular, in this case, our discussion, the female body, has always been, at risk of being abused as a market. You know, whether you want a woman as a worker, whether you want her as a sex worker, or, you know, or a laborer or a prostitute. And now with this new advent of assisted reproductive technology and the acceptance of third party reproduction, you know, using, you know, other people's bodies in order to reproduce. It's just one more area that's open for exploitation and commodification and of women's body. You know, it's definitely a class issue. It's never going to be rich women. You're not going to see a rich movie star offering to be a paid surrogate to her, you know, Salvadorian house cleaner. You're not going to see Barack Obama or whoever's in the White House daughters have to sell their eggs to pay for their college education. I mean, we're naive in telling ourselves that this is all about choice and freedom and autonomy. It is just another area of buying and selling and trading on female bodies.
Well, and it's one of the things that, I mean, the argument that it's all choice is really the triumph of neoliberalism, because that's happened with neoliberalism has, kicked the legs out from under so many different movements for social justice by implying that, or by stating explicitly that it's all about personal choice. So environmentalism has just had, in the 1990s, had the legs cut out from under it by this notion that what is green is your consumer choices as opposed to organized political resistance. And you can see this all through a lot of different movements of how this notion it's all about choice has just been terribly harmful for any sort of social resistance to any forms of systematic oppression.
Yeah, and I don't know what your solution or suggestion for change is, and you know, I see myself as an advocate. I see myself as a public health advocate as well as an advocate for individuals. I see myself as an educator, which is why I got into documentary filmmaking, because I think it's a story war, and right now we're competing with stories. And sometimes the people with the biggest megaphone, who often have the biggest wallets, are sort of sucking out all the oxygen in the debate. But, you know, I don't, I just, And I guess I do just get back to my years of working in healthcare, thinking, you know, what has happened to this tradition of medicine that, like you said, do no harm, when everything has a price tag and everything is motivated by how much money can I make?
Well, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I guess I have a couple questions to sort of wind down. And the first one is, if you could have the listeners of this interview take away one thing from this that they really understand and they really, 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 really get, what would it be? And the second question is going to be, so what do you want? Let's say that these people get the point you want them, that you would like them to understand. What do you want them to do? How can they learn about more of your work? And then finally, what would you like to see on the larger social scale concerning these particular issues?
Yeah, I think the key thing is, and we've seen this over and over again because we've done a lot of surveys of audiences that have seen our film Exploitation before and after. So what I want your listeners to take away from it is that egg donation is not like blood donation, that there are serious and significant short and long-term harms, and there's a whole host of unknown harms because we haven't studied this. So I think that's the most important thing, that you know, all the advertisement, all the glamour, you know, healthy, happy, smiling couples holding cute little chubby babies is all marketing. And that the underbelly is, there are serious and significant risks to women who just make the decision or feel that this is a choice that they're making. I'm sorry, I forgot your second question.
Second question is, I guess you've really answered the first two questions. So second question is, what do you want people who then get that point, what do you want them to do?
Well, of course, I would like everybody to watch the film Exploitation, because then they will be much more educated to go out and speak to others about the practice. And then, you know, I would love them to tell any young girl that's headed off to college or any young girl who sees this as their solution to their financial situation, you know, to tell them no and to be informed on why, not just no, don't do it, you might hurt yourself. But, you know, if you watch the film, you'll hear live testimonials of people that were harm, that had strokes, that lost their ability to ever have their own children, that went on and developed cancer, you know, had to have double mastectomies. All those kinds of things, you know, will become very real and natural, and just telling other people, don't do this. You know, we can shut down the market. It's just like with back to big tobacco. You know, how many people don't smoke now because we've done such a great job? Not that we need to stop. We need to keep doing it. Telling people, don't smoke. It's bad for you and it's bad for others. And I think a victory for us would be that we would see policy changes. We would see global international markets that would say, our global international policies that would say, stop, just like we don't traffic and trade in human beings, just like we don't allow the traffic and trading of organs on the black market or the open market, in the same way we don't allow and condone and permit the trafficking of reproductive body parts on the global market.
Well, thank you so much for everything you said, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jennifer Lall. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.